Blog Talk Radio.
Well, the Wednesday version of American Sports History Podcast, yours truly, Mark Mancini, producing it in Los Angeles. It's hosted by a good friend, a brother, and a mentor to me, Peter Ray, 347-205-9631. It goes by quick. Catch the archive on blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports, podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So without further ado, more of him, less of me. Let me lay that red carpet down, put that podium in its place, hand off the mic. First of all, Peter, the threes, how are you? How can people get a hold of you? And boy, are you bringing another legend through your great show that keeps picking up steam. We are looking at 92 live right now.
Hi, Mark. I'm doing well. I have a YouTube channel. We make history videos. The channel name is my name, Peter J. Rea. And you're absolutely right. Tonight's guest played in the NFL from 1979 to 1987. He was an offensive lineman, offensive guard, and offensive tackle. And he played in the Pro Bowl 1982. He was an NFL All-Rookie Team 1979. He was drafted in the first round, 10th overall, and he wrote a wonderful book just finished today, Black and Honolulu Blue, In the Trenches of the NFL by Keith Dorney, 2003. Welcome to the show, Mr. Keith Dorney.
Peter, thanks for having an old guy like me on. I appreciate it.
Oh, well, I'm an old – that's how it is when old guys want to talk to other old guys because we go back the same time period. You know, the thing I liked about your book, as you got to the end of it, you talked at the end about looking back on your career. You know, you finished your career in 87, then you wrote the book about 16 years later, and then you were looking back and you talked about, you know, you were thinking about all the people in your life, and that's true for all of us, you know. So that's why I'd like to focus on tonight, the people in that you talked about in your book that I'm sure were important to you and still are, starting with your coach at Penn State, Joe Paterno. What can you say about Joe Paterno?
Well, yeah, Joe Paterno kind of had a love-hate relationship with old Joe. I kind of came in loving him and went out hating him, actually. Him and me, he was a kind of a peculiar guy. He went to school in the Ivy League. I think he was an English major and, was a bit of an intellect. And, yeah, I think he liked to play some head games. He was real nice to me, my first couple of years. But my last 2 years, he's pretty nasty. And
uh-huh.
It's funny. I saw him do the exact same thing to Brad Benson. Brad Benson, another, a great offensive tackle from Penn State who went on. I think he played 11 years with the New York Giants. He was a returning All-American like I was. His senior year, which was my sophomore year, and I saw Joe ride this guy unmercifully, and I just couldn't believe it because I looked up to Brad and all the things that he had done, but a couple years later he was doing the same thing to me. So didn't see eye to eye with Joe and. Wasn't real happy with him when I left the university.
But then years later, you're looking back.
Yeah, years later, I think I know that he had my best interests at heart. I think that we definitely disagreed on a couple of issues that we just kind of agreed to disagree on. And, we mended the fence, and certainly he had a great influence on my life. I think he was a great coach and, had some great assistants as well.
Dennis from Flint, Michigan. Hi, Peter and Keith. Diehard Lions fan here, going to New England this week to watch Campbell and Company break some legs. Okay, so current.
I love it. I love it. old MCDC, as he was known when he played, from what I hear. Motor City Dan Campbell. He kind of caught me a little off guard with that, what was it, nibbling on the kneecap comment that he made when he was first hired. But he's impressed me since then. I admit to watching a couple of Hard Knock episodes for the first time this year, and it seems like the players love to play for him. And that's I think the number one job of a head coach is to have the respect of your players and to have them play super, super hard for you. And it looks like he's doing that. And I just hope that they can keep the momentum going, even though they haven't won a lot of games yet. They've been in them. And when you're a Detroit Lions fan like I've been, ever since 1979, Peter, you learn to lower your expectations a little bit. So if they can win 5 or 6 games, I think I'd be happy.
Gail from Clearwater, Florida, another great show. Heard Keith on some shows here. What a moderator you are, Peter, right up there with some of the best. Thank you so much, Gail. I appreciate that very much. Now, Keith, what can you say about your coach from 1979 to 1984 with the Lions, Monty Clark?
Yeah, Monty Clark, I'll tell you, I love the guy. I love the guy. He's deceased now. How could I not love him? I mean, here Monty Clark, the great offensive line coach from the Miami Dolphins and Don Shula and winning those Super Bowls, a great offensive tackle in his own right in his day with the Cleveland Browns. And his first draft at Detroit, he picks me as his first pick. It was a great situation. I mean, I was a highly motivated individual, and I was very coachable. And I learned a lot, not only from Monty, but also from my position coach, Fred Hoagland, who was Monty's teammate on the Cleveland Browns and was currently working as an engineer. He graduated from the University of Pittsburgh with an engineering degree and played pro ball for 10 years and then went to work as an engineer. Monty got him out of the office and made him an offensive line coach. And I owe a lot to Fred, too. He was a great influence on me as well.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Let me just expound on Monty just a little bit longer.
Sure,
I think he deserves it. Yeah. I think that the Detroit Lions pulled the plug a little prematurely on Monty. I know the shelf life for head coaches in the NFL isn't very long. But I think if they would have given him another year or two, I think we could have had some success, as we did for several years during his regime. So anyway, next question.
Sal from Germantown, Pennsylvania. Penn State days, Keith. They had to be something. Still wish you were drafted by the Philadelphia Eagles.
Well, Sal, that's a real funny story. Now, the head coach of the Philadelphia Eagles in 1979 was, of course, Dick Vermeil. And I met with Dick before the draft. He looked me in the eye, and he sincerely said that if you're available, we're picking you with the 17th pick. And, the Lions picked me up with the 10th pick. Now, the Eagles went on to pick Jerry Robinson, linebacker out of UCLA. He wasn't too shabby, so I'm sure they were happy with him. But I almost had that dream, Sal, of playing for Penn State and then going to the Super Bowl with the Eagles. What could have been, right?
Ron from Lincoln, Nebraska, home where coaches retire here and make boatloads of money. Keith, any thoughts on the NFL? Too political these days. Hard to watch, kneeling, assault, etc.
Well, I don't know if I really agree with that statement. I think that just like there's all types of individuals across our great country, United States of America, the makeup of the team, very similar. We got the country boys, we got the city folk, all coming together and, trying to play as one. So, I think some political discourse going to, seep into the game. I think that the NFL tries to keep it out as much as it can. But I personally, that doesn't bother me, and personally, I wouldn't be surprised if we see a little bit more of it in the future.
Michael from Charlotte, North Carolina, any team that you hated to play in college or the pros, tough to play against, and the guy you owned in the trenches?
Okay, that's a great question. That's a great question. Let's see. As far as the pros go, I played against a lot of great defensive ends. I started off, Jack Youngblood. Played against Pittsburgh with Mean Joe Green and Jack Lambert. Battled Dan Hampton, with the Hall of Fame defensive end from the Chicago Bears twice a year. Played against Ed Too Tall Jones many times, as well as Howie Long. But probably the toughest guy I ever faced was Reggie White. And the reason that he was so good, big guys, like William the Refrigerator Perry, he'd line up over me, and it was a pass rush. I knew he was going to try to run me over. So that wasn't a problem for me. Other guys, super, super quick, right? And I knew that they were going to try to run around me. But Reggie could do both. He could run around you and run over you, which presented some problems for an offensive tackle. So, I gotta give best of all time as far as my view to Reggie White.
Okay, some more. Go ahead.
No. I'm done. Go ahead.
Okay, no more people from your playing days. What are your thoughts on Russ Bollinger, your line mate on the Detroit Lions?
Oh man, Russ. I love Russ Bollinger. I love Russ Bollinger. He was my teammate early on. Was an older guy when I came into the league in 1979. So, I always looked up to him. And Russ not only was a great offensive guard, I played next to him for years, but he's a great person and a great friend. He went on to scout pro football for many different teams, including the Detroit Lions, and currently makes his home in Michigan. And I can't say enough about the guy.
Chris Dietrich, he was your gym partner.
Yeah. Well, Chris Dietrich, he for years, was the left tackle. I was the right tackle. He was also my roommate before I got married. I lived with him for 2 years, and we spent a lot of time in the weight room together. Both of us realized that probably the best thing that we could do to help ourselves be better football players, better offensive linemen, to help the team was to get stronger. Yeah, we spent a lot of time in that Lion weight room together too.
Dave Purifoy.
Yeah, Dave Purifoy. Now,
Purifoy. How do you say that name?
Yeah, that's Dave Purifoy. Now, Dave,
okay.
Unfortunately, is Dave Purifoy. Dave is unfortunately has passed. Peter if you recall the first chapter of my book, Black and Honolulu Blue, that you just read, I was talking about Dave Purifoy in that first chapter.
Right.
Dave Purifoy, I remember, people referring to him by these different nicknames. At first, I thought he was like two or three different guys, right? They called him Switchblade because he had that incredibly fast first step. They also called him Lowrider because he was built really, really compact and, you know, really could squeeze that corner. And I think my favorite nickname of his was Orwell, some badass character, in an old video. But anyway, he gave me fit. For the first couple of weeks of training camp, he made my life a living hell, as did a lot of the other, defensive linemen as far as that first round draft choice coming in. I persevered. I gained his respect, and we actually became very good friends. And he helped me a lot. He helped me a lot trying to block individuals like himself.
Yeah, I like your description when you're talking about this guy. You're like, oh my God, this guy is, and then he, like you said, he was, testing you, or of course, it's, you guys are in a tough business, so you got to be tough, real tough. And so I liked how that turned out. And then he became such a good friend, giving you ideas, and all these different help, being very helpful and a good friend. So that was very, very interesting how that worked out.
Yeah, absolutely. And whenever, Peter, you talk to an old guy like me that, that was, in one of the hitting positions, you'll hear this. Like, that was back when football was football. But seriously, I mean, we hit, every single day, twice a day, actually, for 2-a-days. Our 2-a-days lasted 2 months, all right, not 2 weeks. And again, we used to hit during the week, sometimes on Saturdays before a Sunday game. So, it was, I think the razzing of rookies probably was a little more vigorous back then than it is today.
Another guy, Al Bubba Baker.
Al Baker, if he was my opponent rather than my teammate, he probably would have been right up there with Reggie White. He was incredible. He was an incredible pass rusher. I remember, coming in and his work ethic. My rookie year, my second year. I mean, his work ethic was incredible. He'd be working, after practice, on all these different pass rush moves, and the fact that, he was very large man, tall in stature, as well as very, very long arms. That gave him a lot of advantages, as far as, grabbing and spinning and such. So, yeah, I was a privilege to play with Al Bubba Baker. And I'm seriously glad I didn't have to play against him in games, because he was a bitch in practice.
Yeah, he came to Cleveland, and people remember him well here. He was an important part of the Cleveland Browns, I think, after he left Detroit.
Absolutely.
Now, you talked about you played your entire career with the Lions in the Pontiac Silverdome. You're talking about how the cigarette smoke and about – now, you look back on it, do you find it hard to believe that you guys played in that place that were it's hard to believe the way they set it up, that it was just a ridiculous, what it was doing, it was just so hard, so ruining you guys, so hard on you guys, on your bodies, playing on concrete, basically.
Right, I went on and on, I know, in my book about the Pontiac Silverdome and its surface. One reader actually gave me a very good compliment one time, and she said, I felt like the Pontiac Silverdome was one of the characters in your book.
Okay.
Now the city of Pontiac owned the Silverdome. The Lions didn't own the Silverdome, and the city of Pontiac was not a very wealthy city. we had this turf that was just really, really old. And it was old and crumbly because, well, the city of Pontiac was trying to make money with the Silver Dome. So, you know, a typical week might see the Rolling Stones playing, Wednesday, and there's a truck pull on Saturday with it, you know, a game on Sunday. So they're constantly rolling and re-rolling the turf. It was infamous for its many seams, which ended quite a few people's career. I know Tom Turner's career, a fellow offensive line mate of mine. I remember his incident very clearly. And I remember going out and looking at these rolls, when they were up and before they put them out, it was pitiful. The little under pad, white under pad was just almost non-existent, and the surface itself, you know, the green part was just filthy. Many times an astroturf burn, you know, which you get all the time, turned into a staph infection during the week because of some, you know, putrid substance on, you know, that was probably in that turf, that transferred to your wound. So I know opponents, you know, hated to play there. And worse, and now they did wise up later on in my career, but for the first 4 or 5 years, we would practice and play on that Silver Dome surface. And, a lot of times they just lay out a little bit of turf, you know, because they're setting up for a basketball game, you know, at a time the Pistons played there as well, or, you know, again, a truck pull or whatever. So playing on that rock hard surface was bad enough, but practicing on it for, a good 5 years, that didn't help my knees either.
Alan from Cranston, Rhode Island. Any thoughts on Billy Sims? Loved watching him run. Wish this show was on longer. Need my fix. Billy Sims. Now, he was 32nd. He's 32nd all-time in rushing. You were the leading blocker. What are your thoughts on Billy Sims?
Well, Billy Sims was a fantastic runner. I missed the other number 20, you know, the more probably famous number 20 by a year. So I didn't get a chance to play with Barry Sanders, but I did get a chance to play with Billy Sims, and boy, you know, what a 4 years we had. You know, he was our first round draft choice, first pick in the draft in 1980. We started the year off by, you know, going out to the Los Angeles Rams and pretty much kicking their butts and, you know, Billy running all over the place. And from then on, we had a lot of success as a team. You know, we were in the top five in rushing, you know, a good bit of Billy's time. And then, unfortunately, he caught his toe in the turf of the Herbert Humphrey Dome up there in Minnesota and, ended his career prematurely. But boy, could that guy run. What a pleasure it was to block for him.
Matt Millen, your teammate at Penn State, I like near the end of the book, you met him. I think he had a top job with the Lions in 2002, and you talked about how the competition was over.
Yeah, it's funny because me and Matt have an incredibly long football history. Our high schools, I went to Emmaus High School in Emmaus, Pennsylvania. He went to Whitehall High School in Whitehall, Pennsylvania. Believe it or not, our high schools used to play each other on Thanksgiving Day. That's how long our football seasons were. They really took football seriously in that part of Pennsylvania, as they do, many other places. So I was a year older than him, but, you know, for 3 years we battled on Thanksgiving. And then I went to Penn State, and then he followed me up to Penn State. And, he was a defensive tackle back in college. Him and Bruce Clark, who was a freak of nature and behemoth in his own right, I had to play against those two knuckleheads every day in practice. And much like Dave Purefoy and Bubba Baker, by the time the games rolled around, it was almost easier, because I was facing a lesser opponent.
Gary Danielson, actually another Cleveland connection. What can you say about Gary Danielson?
Yeah, Gary Danielson, a great quarterback. He was my quarterback for a couple of years there, and went on to be probably a more famous color guy for college football, right? I think he's the number one SEC reporting team. See him on TV all the time. Great quarterback. He was quarterback of one of my playoff losses. We made the playoffs twice while I was with the Detroit Lions, and we lost both games. The more notable game was against San Francisco out at the out at the old stadium, and I remember it was a downpour. Billy was running his tail off, and if we would have won that game, we would have went on to play the Dallas Cowboys in the NFC Championship game. But unfortunately, our 39-yard field goal at the very end of the game was missed, so again, he was our quarterback then, and can't say enough about the guy. Great human being.
Yeah, the 39-yard field goal was, I hate to bring it up, but it was missed by Eddie Murray. Do you still hate kickers 19 years after you wrote your book?
Yeah, well, it's funny. And there's a chapter in my book, Black and Honolulu Blue, effing kickers is the name of the chapter. And, I talked about how, kickers are kind of a different breed, a different breed of animal. I think the main reason that I didn't like kickers was because I'd be, running gassers right across the field, with full pads on after a grueling 2-hour practice, and I look over there and the kickers are sitting on their helmets, grab assing with each other. So I was probably more jealous than anything. I probably wish I was a kicker. I think that's probably why I hate him so much.
Now, John Kolb of the Steelers did not have – he had bare arms during games. And you apparently emulated that. Was there anything else about John Kolb you emulated besides having bare arms in games?
No, not really. I remember even though I grew up a Philadelphia Eagle fan – when I went to Penn State, this is of course way before the internet, and the antenna TV, only picked up Pittsburgh stations. So, I'm doing my laundry usually on Sunday after a game, and throwing the Pittsburgh Steeler game, and I always liked, the look of John Kolb and not having anything on his arms. And I kind of parroted that look throughout my whole career. Now, besides that, as an offensive lineman, you really don't want anything on you extra that a defensive lineman can grab, whether, it's your jersey or an elbow pad. If they get a hold of that, that's leverage that they can disrupt you and get to the passer. So it was kind of a vanity thing, but also a practical thing as well, not wearing anything on my arms.
Now, you had some connection with Joe Namath, and you were the Dudley, Massachusetts donut-eating champion. Was it 50 donuts? Has anyone broken your record?
It is 50 donuts, and as far as I know, my record for eating donuts in Dudley, Massachusetts stands. it was a great thing. I mean, I was I was like, I guess I was 18 years old because I was going into my sophomore year at Penn State, and we had two All-America tackles. I had mentioned Brad Benson and we had two great tackles, but Jopa wanted to get me in the lineup, so he moved me to center my sophomore year. So, I had played center during spring practice, snapped a little bit, and then I had an opportunity to go to this Joe Namath football camp up in Dudley, Massachusetts. So the first day I'm out there, and Joe Namath is taking snaps from me. And, you know, I just barely was a center, so I was afraid I was going to break his hand. Luckily I didn't. That was actually a great time. I was up there with my great friend Billy Glenn, who was a quarterback at Lehigh University, lifetime friend. And we went up there as counselors and just had a blast. And, we'd go out for maybe a refreshment or two, you know, after we put the boys to sleep. And Joe Namath was just like one of the regular guys. He would come out and, you know, have a beer or two with us. And we always would end up at the local Dunkin' Donuts. And the strength coach at the time of the New York Jets, Paul Mastrocoba, he was a real funny guy, and he would take over as server, and you know we'd go and he'd go and he'd have this whole routine about the donuts being stale, you know, knocking on the bottom of the table. And, one night we had a donut eating contest, and, you know, I felt like I was on the verge of becoming a big guy, right? I was still maturing. I was just 18, but I started to put the pounds on. I was, you know, up now 250, 255. So, yeah, 50 donuts. That's a lot of donuts. I don't think I could do that today.
Well, the time has flown by. Our guest has been Mr. Keith Durney, who played for the Detroit Lions in the NFL from 1979 to 1987. He's the author of the 2003 book, Black and Honolulu Blue, In the Trenches of the NFL. Keith, do you have any final words tonight for our audience?
Yes. First off, Peter, it's been a pleasure, being on this podcast with you, you know, talking some football. On a personal note, I went on to write many other books besides Black and Honolulu Blue, all of them financially related, okay? So if you want to check some of those books out, I have a book on a Roth IRA, another on a health savings account, another on getting out of debt. Go to KeithDorney.com and check them out. I also have a free Best Money newsletter that you can sign up for. It publishes every month on the full moon. And it's not only talks about a money management topic, all right, in great detail, but also reveals some personal stuff about myself as well. So, again, love to have you as a reader. And that's KeithDorney.com. Thanks.
Oh, sure. Wonderful. Thanks for that information. Wonderful. Really tremendous having you on the show, Mr. Keith Durney. Thank you so much. Next week, we're going to have Bill North again, I think for the seventh time, the center fielder and leadoff hitter for the coolest MLB team of all time, the Oakland A's from the early 1970s. Dear listener, may the road rise to meet you. May the wind be at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face and rains fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Good night, everybody. Thanks again, Mr. Keith Durney.
Thank you, Peter.